Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, Chris Evans here. Happy belated new year and welcome to the first edition of the Best of the Breakfast Show podcast of 2021 with Sky from Virgin Radio. Coming up, Virgin Radio's shiny new host, the one and only Graham Norton, tells us what to expect from his shiny new radio show, the Graham Norton Radio Show, which you can hear every Saturday and Sunday between 9:30 and 12:30 here on Virgin Radio. Author, podcaster, presenter and so much more, the wonderful Fern Cotton dishes out wisdom from her new book, Speak Your Truth. Superstar actress Jenna Coleman gets us all excited for her seductive and shocking new BBC One series, The Serpent. All episodes available now via the BBC iPlayer. And the up-and-coming acting excellence of Kingsley Benadire tells the tale of playing Malcolm X in the incredible new Amazon movie, One Night in Miami. All of that and loads more still to come. Now, Dapper Dave, tell us who's first.
The wait is almost over. Your Saturdays and Sundays are about to go stratospheric. His weekend shows start tomorrow on Virgin Radio at 9:30 a.m. So please welcome the man that'll be making your weekends a whole lot more wonderful in his own inimitable way. It's Virgin Radio's very own Graham Norton!
Yes! A lovely day! Graham, how cool is this, man?
Well, it's cool. It's also intimidating because I'm thinking, you know, it's just me talking. You know, that's all the show is. It's just me, some records of me talking. I feel like people are going to go, I'm going to heal the sick.
You are. You have magical powers. You have magical radio superpowers. I can't wait. I know what you mean because it's a radio show.
There's only so much you can do.
Yeah, it's not like a West End production or a Hollywood movie or a brand new sort of trilogy or a brand new kind of mega franchise, you know, or a Netflix special or anything like that. But as a listener, I am genuinely really looking forward to having you on my radio, in my life, on Saturdays, and particularly on Sundays, for some reason. I'm looking forward to it.
We did a little kind of dummy run-through in here the other night, and it's fun. I liked it. I really liked it. I think the first couple of weekends will just be me talking about the room, the view.
I've done all that. I've heard all that before.
No, I know. That's the thing. Well, you can't stop. You kind of think this must be so boring to a listener, and yet you can't stop yourself. But I'll try. I'll try to wean myself off. But that's probably about the first 2 weekends.
So tell us, how come you were excited about the dummy run? Because I know what you mean, but just convey that to the listener.
Well, you're coming into this studio. It's a very glitzy, you know, it's all bells and whistles, fancy lights and things. And also, here's my confession.
Come on.
At the radio too, yes. I was never allowed, I was never given permission to touch a button. I would just, you know, I had kind of gloves on and I would just stand, you know, sit there and talk. And so everything happened around me. But here, I'm pushing some buttons, which... it's pathetic how excited that makes me. It's also frightening because you know that thing when you've learned to drive, you pass your test,
yes,
and then you're on the motorway and you're like, this isn't illegal, but it should be because I have no idea what I'm doing. So it's a bit like that. It's like, okay, this is actually on air. I'm really doing this. So we'll see how we get on. There might be a few glitches along the way.
But it's going to be fun. It's going to be fun. So what's going to happen on the show? Similar to the old place on Saturdays?
It's really similar. It's me doing a bit of gabbing. My old mucker, Maria McCurlin, will be here. We'll have some problems. We've got a few guests. Tomorrow we've got Faye Ripley and Ralph Little and lots of good music. And, I think it's a jolly listen for a Saturday morning and a Sunday.
Yeah, and because you got the Sunday show as well, you know, it is a sort of two-parter, isn't it? Because there was the famous book, which I'm a huge fan of. I reread it over the Christmas period. Tim Ferriss's The 4-Hour Workweek. Now, we've got Graham up to 7. No, and it's work in progress.
I must say, I keep forgetting about the Sunday. I hope I show up. I was in the supermarket yesterday and I was looking at avocados thinking, oh, that'd be nice on Sunday. Oh, no.
No.
I won't be doing that, will I? I will not be chopping up avocados.
And so how will Sunday differ? Again, you know, we're not talking any kind of, you know, Van Gogh masterpiece here, but it is just the radio show. But
I'm glad you're managing people's expectations.
No, because it's going to be fantastic. But how will Sunday differ in sort of mood and feel?
I think we'll kind of take it from the listeners, because I haven't done Sunday before. Now, in my head, I think you're a little more city down on a Sunday.
Yes.
You're a little bit mellower on a Sunday. Mm. That's my feeling.
Right.
Because I think Saturday is the day you do stuff. You're buying things, you're ferrying the kids somewhere. Mind you, at the moment, you're probably not. But every day is quite city down.
But that'll be the same energy will be there on a Saturday morning, I would imagine.
I would have thought so. And then Sunday, I think the main thing will be maybe the music might be a bit more mellow on a Sunday, and I might be a bit more mellow on a Sunday. I don't know what I sound like on a Sunday, so we'll find out.
Well, for that conversation, let's see Saturday nights in the Norton household. So what do you usually do on a Saturday night? Because that's going to affect your Sundays.
Well, all bets are off because Saturday nights aren't Saturday nights
what
anymore.
What would you usually do?
I suppose normally on a Saturday night I would be out. But like for a dinner or something, not like I would be bonkers. But at the moment, like everyone else, I suppose what the difference is that I won't watch the 7th and 8th episode of something.
Right.
I'll go to bed. That's the plan.
Okay.
Because on a Saturday, you kind of think, oh, I'll just finish this series because I don't have to be up.
Yeah. What time might you get up for a show at 9:30 on a Sunday, do you think?
All right, Chris.
I'm just interested. Will you have a walk?
10 to 9. No, I think tomorrow. Tomorrow, since you asked, I'll now tell you.
Yeah.
I think tomorrow I'll get up about 8. I think.
Right.
And then, no, I'll get up about 7:30.
Half seven.
And then I'll leave the house about 8:30. And then I should be here just before 9. Well, no, I'll be here about 10 to 9, 9:15.
Right.
And then it'll happen.
It's so
at
cool.
At 9:30.
It's so cool. I'm so
and also, this building, is downstairs. I said to you off air, it looks like I've died. It's the Graham Norton Mausoleum. I'm making my own country.
It looks amazing. So we have these big screens here all throughout the building on the news tower here. All the way up all the stairs, every floor, when the lifts open, you have these big sort of pixelated screens, and you have loads of them in reception. If you walk past and you go through between Borough Market and London Bridge train station, you can see them, and Graham's face is all over them today. It's like you were on a Sunset Strip, and you've just got a new movie coming out.
No, it is. I do.
You look great.
I feel like
in the
Barry
photos.
Manilow in Vegas or something. It's very exciting.
Also, when you present your pass to the infrared thing.
Yes.
Do you know that your pass? There's an algorithm that tells something somewhere who you are and where you're going. And between you going through the automated barrier, a lift will come down for you. And this is for everybody who works in the building, all 3,500 people, because it knows where you work and it will take you there.
Wow.
Come on.
Oh, and yes. Apparently, executive bathrooms. That's what I've heard. I've heard executive bathrooms.
That's a myth. They knew that'd swing it for him.
I'm not signing that contract.
Get the contract signed now.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
She's the podcasting go-to guru that created her very own Happy Place empire. Her latest life-enhancing book, Speak Your Truth, is out today. And here to tell us more, loud and proud, is someone that will not be silenced. It's the excellent Fern Cotton.
Good morning, Fern.
Morning, everyone.
How are you? Very well. How are you?
Good. Yeah, usual sort of anticipation of releasing a book, but, you know, all okay.
How many books in are you now, Fern?
1, 2, 3, 4, I don't know, 10, 7, 8, but these are including kids' books, cookbooks as well.
It's pretty impressive, though, when you don't know, because it's been quite a few. There have been so many that you go, I think maybe it's double figures now. Well, Fern, congratulations. Yeah. Speak Your Truth. Now, tell us about the story from whence this story came, and it's you not losing your voice, but not being able to speak. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I knew I needed to write another book, so I was kind of thinking, oh, God, what am I going to write about now? And at this point, this was about a year ago, my voice just sort of fell apart. I was sort of doing a bunch of voiceover work and and TV stuff, and my voice just kind of went. So I saw a throat specialist who put a little camera down my nose and discovered quite a sizable cyst on my vocal cords. So I kind of got in the cab after that, knowing there was an operation looming, and thought, this is really curious. Like, why is it there on my body? What is it about my throat that I need to look at here? And that kind of led me down a path of exploration to look into how we use our voice and how we speak, and if we speak truthfully or if we're swallowing downwards or saying things that we know aren't necessarily true to who we are. So that's the sort of crux of the book, essentially.
And so that silence, almost like a sort of involuntary silent retreat. What did you find, you know, as well as other than the thoughts of maybe, you know, getting this together and composing a book from it, what kind of things did you have simmering that you couldn't get out there, couldn't sort of release yourself from, and therefore took hold of you, and you thought, hang on a minute, these are in there and they're probably in there for a while, and what I usually do is just talk a lot, and then that relieves a bit of the pressure, but that wasn't an option this time.
No, you're right. I think, you know, if you are a communicator, or, you know, just anybody really, talking and discussing things, whether it's healthily or in a more negative light, is a big distraction, rather than actually sitting with stuff and sitting with feelings and sitting with concerns and stuff you're ruminating on. So I did have to kind of sit with a lot of stuff. And because I was thinking about this subject matter, I think I realized how often I've not been honest. I've not been honest with myself, and I've really not been honest with others, because I've been scared of either rejection or getting in trouble, saying something wrong, or being, you know, just kind of thought of in a way that I don't believe represents me. So I think, you know, I probably had the pressure piled on slightly more, like you, because people are listening to you and dissecting what you're saying. But it counts for everybody. You know, often we'll say yes when really we mean no. Often we won't follow what our gut says because we're so busy worrying about what everybody else thinks about us. It's tiny things every day that we're dealing with. But it's powerful, I think, when you start really doing what feels right to you and saying what feels right to you. I think it's really potent.
It's funny, isn't it? Because not telling the truth is a common human trait. In fact, it's almost natural to us to not tell the truth. It's bizarre, isn't it? It's not that. Are you lying, or are you just not telling the truth? Have you suppressed the truth to such an extent that you don't know what it is anymore anyway? Or you've at least
That's
suppressed
it.
So it cannot be heard unless you're not able to speak for 2 weeks. Which is
this isn't like lying is such a different thing.
Yeah.
Lying is when you know you're saying something to cover up or to cheat or get out of something. But I think not telling the truth is an everyday occurrence, because, you know, even if someone goes to, oh my God, do you remember that scene in The Godfather, and you've never seen like that classic, you go, oh yeah. And you've not seen it, but you're too scared to admit that you haven't seen it. It's silly stuff every day. And I think as soon as we get comfy with who we are, what we're about, and what we want to say, it's really liberating.
Yeah, well, it is really liberating, but as with many things that you've discussed in your books, all brilliantly, you know, it's once the cat's out of the bag, that's only the beginning of the process, isn't it? So it's whether people want to take that step. You know, is it worth the trouble? What's been your experience?
I think always nearly yes. Like, none of this is easy. It's not like, yes, I spoke my truth and then I was liberated. I think it is, there
practice,
is a sort of a
it?
Transition. It's a practice, and there's a transitional period, you know, where you kind of get comfy with it, and other people around you get comfy with your life choices. You know, we're talking about big stuff as well, like, you know, what you want to do career-wise, your, you know, sexuality, who you want to hang out with, who you want to associate with, what beliefs you have, what you want to align with. This is like big juicy stuff, and it's not going to please everybody. So I think it is incremental, and you've just got to kind of slowly do it and get comfy with it. But I think nearly always, yes, it's better than swallowing words, suppressing what you know you're about, because that just causes mental stress, physical tension, you know, feeling irritable and angry about life. I think it's better to just sort of incrementally test the waters and give it a go.
Well, Fern, well done. How's your day looking today with all the promo for this?
Oh, God. Well, look, I'm trying to juggle that and homeschooling two kids. I'm not going to lie, it's a blimmin' nightmare. I literally was, like, about to cry last night thinking about all this. It's just bonkers. Like, how us parents are meant to deal with this, I don't know. But I'm going to give it my best shot.
All right, well, this too will end, Fern. You know that.
I know.
This too will end. Great. Lovely to talk to you again, Fern.
Thank you, Chris. Big love.
Big love to you. Fern Cotton is Tyler, seeker of the truth. This is a beautiful book, says Elizabeth Gilbert on the front cover. Fern Cotton, Speak Your Truth, connecting with your inner truth and learning to find your inner voice is out today.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
She's venerable in Victoria, delightful in Doctor Who, and now French in her new show. The darkly delicious series The Serpent continues this Sunday at 9 p.m. on BBC One. So let's say bonjour, madame, to the lady that always snake charms us. It's the brilliant Jenna Coleman.
All right, Jenna.
Good morning.
Your new show is so good, Jenna.
Oh, thank you.
It really is. It really is. Because I sometimes, when we have guests on, I watch shows on fast forward because, you know, there are only so many hours in the day. And you can tell when a show has been stretched. And with yours, you can't watch it on fast forward because so much happens all the time. I mean, it's quite a simple story, but there's so much in it, so much detail. You can fill in the gaps in a moment or two, but briefly, an overview of this, everyone, if you haven't seen it yet or even heard of it, as I hadn't until I knew Jenna was coming on the show. The Serpent is an 8-part series. It's all available on the BBC iPlayer now. All episodes available on demand if you want to binge it over the next few weeks. And stylized-wise, it's a cross between, or it's a sort of, it has the kind of ingredients, the kind of look, the kind of smell, the kind of feel, the kind of vibe, the kind of groove of Narcos, if you are familiar with that, or Boardwalk Empire, or American Hustle. It's got that kind of thing going on, a bit of Salvador going on there. But Jenna, you pitch it to us as if we were going to buy it from you.
I love that. I love that. I love that description. It's an 8-part series about the real life story of Charles Sobhraj, who was he's now in jail for murder. And it's about the hippies and the hippie trail in the 1970s and the people who come into contact with him. And he used to drug the hippies and take their money. And then we also followed a story of Herman Nippenberg, a Dutch diplomat, who tracks him down.
Tell us about your character. Tell us about the Frenchness of her. And now you, I'm understanding. And how they get Stevenage or wherever it is to look like Paris, Egypt and everywhere else in 6 days because they had to because of lockdown.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say there is such a... It feels like such a kind of momentous occasion because I feel like there were so many points where we thought this is never going to make it to screen. Like there were so many obstacles that came in the way. And we began filming in August 2019. So it's kind of stretched over a period of 13 months, the shoot. And we had to, in lockdown, obviously as the virus came in, we got flown back from Bangkok with a few hours notice and then picked up the rest of the story in Tring, which acted as Paris, Bombay, Karachi, and many other locations that kind of work seamlessly on screen.
And you can't tell. So, you know, I mean, I know you obviously had fun going to those far-flung places, but, you know, these SFX people and the set builders, they could be too good at their jobs bearing the future in mind.
Yeah, I mean, we've got this amazing set designer called Francois who did Carlos, actually. There's an amazing series, I think it's on Amazon, called Carlos, about that guy in the 1970s. So we had the same set designer as him, which obviously, you know, we did certain scenes in Paris and Bangkok. It was very, as you see in their series, it switches and changes locations all the time.
And it's funny, isn't it? Because it's like a Beautiful South song. Because, you know, a Beautiful South, they always have really sort of happy sort of rainbow melodies. But if you listen to the words, they're really cutting and full of satire. And,
yeah.
You know, if you watch this show with the sound down and you miss out certain scenes, it's like a funk groove fest that you want to be part of. But of course, it's entirely the opposite.
Yeah. For me, especially like when I watched episode one and you first followed the first victim story, Teresa, and you see her kind of the hippie style, the liberation and her purity meets the serpent, the kind of the dark cobra. And there's something really, when I read the script, I became fascinated by him and kind of it's quite obsessive because he's so intoxicating and seductive, which is what makes it so so disturbing.
The first scene, you know, when he's being interviewed of the first episode, I mean, that just, it just hits the ground running, doesn't it? It's just so grippy. You think, what is this about? And I said to my wife, I said, how is it? I said, babe, you got to watch it, because she goes to sleep later than I do. She says, really? I said, no. I said, it's Chernobyl good. It's really fantastic. So congratulations to you and everybody involved in it. Now, your character, she's French or, you know...
Quebecois?
Yeah, exactly. But there are two of her, in a way, because she has an alter ego.
Yeah. So that's... And again, in real life, because there's loads of tapes that I got to listen to for research of her in prison... Like the real Charles Sobhraj and the real Marie-Andre in prison. So she'd never left Canada. Like, she was really, she was quite devout Catholic and grew up in Quebecois, in Quebec, and had never really traveled before. And upon meeting Charles Sobhraj, within 3 weeks, she was drugging people. So, yeah, the kind of the line of, is she a victim? How much of an accomplice was she is what we investigate throughout the series.
Yeah. And again, you know, that has that title to it that says all conversations are imagined, but the imagining of these conversations. Who's the guy that wrote it? What's he done before?
Richard Warlow. He did Ripper Street.
It's as good as it gets, isn't it, for telly?
Yeah, I mean, as well, and when I got some scripts, I read the first six in a row, and I had all of the research material and cuttings and images of them. And as well, she kept the name Monique throughout her days in prison. Like, she kept that name, the name that Charles Sobhraj gave her, and the kind of the character that he built around. Like, she kept that for the rest of her life, which I think was really, really telling.
Really telling, yeah.
But yeah, Richard had, I mean, the scripts were so incredible. And then obviously he had to, alter and change things so to make it work in Tring and to make the series still exist.
Well, I think it's awesome. Awesome. I really do. So well done.
Thank you.
No, you're very welcome. What are you doing? What's happened since 8 p.m. last night in your world?
Well, I've been at home.
No, you know what I mean with regards to the near future.
Yeah, not much, to be honest. Just kind of mentally preparing that this is where we are until, come March.
Yeah.
Staying at home.
Staying at home. Plenty of good stuff to watch on the telly. Thank heaven.
Exactly, yeah.
From you and your lot. Right, Jenna Coleman, The Serpent. The Serpent, episode 3 of 8, Sunday 9 p.m. BBC One. But of course, BBC iPlayer is where you can go to watch them all today. Thank you, Jenna.
Thank you.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is the Best of the Breakfast Show podcast of 2021 with Sky from Virgin Radio. We've heard from a whole host of tip-top guests, but can you believe it? There's still so much more to come. On the way, the dashing Tom Hughes gets us cackling with delight over the second series of Sky One's A Discovery of Witches. Super chef Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall whips our diets into shape with his new book, Eat Better Forever. Super cool brainiac columnist Bryony Gordon wows us with witticisms from her new book, No Such Thing as Normal, which is awesome. And the dynamic plant-based duo of Stephen and David Flynn, aka The Happy Pair, wants you to get your veggies ready with their new cookbook, The Happy Health Plan. All of that and more still to come. So let's get right back to the action. Dapper Dave, who is next?
He's the Brit busting his way into Hollywood one powerhouse performance at a time. He stars in the incredible new movie One Night in Miami, which drops on Amazon Prime Video next Friday. Ladies and gents, please welcome a man that puts in the most Malcolm excellent of performances. It's Kingsley Benadire.
Good morning, Kingsley.
How you doing, Chris?
Okay, I'm very well. How are you?
I'm pretty good. What an introduction. Thank you.
Congratulations on this new creation of yours and your pals, One Night in Miami. Amazon Prime Video released next Friday, week tomorrow, 15th of Jan. So did this night actually happen? Did this event actually happen?
It did. And I think that was, you know, Kemp's inspiration was finding out that this night did happen and his sort of wondering, you know, what they may or may have not spoken about. But yeah, it did happen. And I think the next morning Cash came out and announced that he was changing his name and converting to the Nation of Islam. And, you know, within a year, Sam and Malcolm would both, you know, sadly be dead. But yeah, this night happened. No one knows what they actually said, but that was the inspiration.
Okay, so the night in question is, this is a story of what happened, what might have happened when Cassius Clay, Malcolm X, Jim Brown and Sam Cooke find themselves in the same room in a night. When? What was the year? What was going on at the time?
This is February the 25th, 1964. I speak for Malcolm, really, because obviously he's the character I play and the character who I sort of... I studied in depth, and I feel like this is a really interesting time for Malcolm because there were so many monumental changes going on for him in terms of his thinking and his situation with the Nation of Islam. I felt like there was a really strong sense, I think my research showed me anyway, that he was being pushed out of the nation in a very real way. He was currently on a, he was on a suspension on this night, and his relationship with Elijah Muhammad, who was his father figure and mentor, really was essentially crumbling. I think there was also a really strong feeling that the FBI were really onto him, and yeah, and I think his politics and his religious beliefs were really going for a massive shift. So I think we're meeting Malcolm in this film at a really interesting point, and I think for me that was like so much of what I found appealing about this, because obviously there's a performance of Malcolm X that is iconic, and you know, I wanted to make sure that this opportunity or this Malcolm was going to be something very different and a Malcolm that we haven't seen before. And so much of that was to do with the vulnerability, not just of him, but of all of these men together. Like, this is a Malcolm in private with his friends, sharing and laughing and discussing, and so much of the Malcolm that we know is in the media and so often in response to the most like hideous racial injustices. And you're often the clips that we have of Malcolm on YouTube are always him in response to like just racist white America, basically. So this was a really interesting opportunity where I thought, oh man, we can show Malcolm as a dad and Malcolm as a friend and Malcolm as a, you know, a kind, gentle human being that he was. One of the most amazing parts of my research was an interview, dear friend of Malcolm's, Dick Gregory, that I read. And he sort of describes Malcolm in a really different way. And he said that Malcolm was actually a very sweet and bashful man, a really good humored, and the lacerating demagogue that we all know is really a character that he slipped in and out of, but really wasn't the sum total of who he was. And that sort of blew my mind and gave me full permission to dive in and explore that sort of more fragile, vulnerable side of Malcolm.
I thought one of the most telling scenes in it, the whole movie, was when he has to flee his own house because it's being set on fire, and he's semi-naked, he's with his family, their lives are in great danger, as his life always was, and ultimately we know what happened as far as that's concerned. But he was frightened, he was fearful, he was cowering over the opposite side of the street, you know, with a gun in hand, almost not knowing really what he was going to do with it, if he had to do anything with it at all.
No, if the second bomb had gone through that window, it would have landed on his two-year-old daughter.
Yeah.
Like, there's an interview on YouTube that I studied in depth of Malcolm, maybe 24 hours after that incident. And he's very heavily drugged up from, you know, painkillers or the sleeping pills that he was taking, and apologizing for how he looked because his clothes still smelled of smoke and everything was burnt in the house.
Crazy.
Like, it's crazy. And also, Malcolm's experience with fire started a lot earlier. His dad was murdered by the Black Legion, or, you know, some white supremacist group. And his house was also bombed when he was a kid. So, like, his experience of racism was so deeply profound.
Yeah.
Like, but that scene was a really powerful scene to think about and reflect on and film. And it was a tricky night because we had the little girls, and they just wanted to have a good time, and they found their own friendship, and we were trying. It was really tricky to get them into the state of, like, you know, panic and fear that we needed.
Yeah.
But Regina did a fantastic job of of freaking them out.
Well, look at you now. So Malcolm X one day, Barack Obama the next. Kingsley, now 34 years old, ladies and gentlemen. Kingsley's career started on stage, including plays with Mark Rylance's Much Ado About Nothing at the Old Vic, alongside legends Vanessa Redgrave and James Earl Jones. Do you feel like you might have graduated by now?
graduated from what? Drama school?
Just from generally being, you know, a junior on the block, a new kid on the block too. Where are you? You know, if acting was a school, which grade are you in now?
I'm just starting off, Chris. That's how I feel. I feel like I'm just at the beginning of learning, and like, you know, so much of this job is just like trying to survive. Yep. And just trying to like make a living. And if you're lucky enough to get to think about, you know, choice of character or type of job that you want to do, yeah, like that's just such a huge achievement. And I feel like just maybe in the last few months, I think this sort of connection with Regina and Malcolm, I'm kind of starting to, you know, the material that's coming in is sort of changing slowly and getting better. And, you know, the conversations with directors are, you know, are starting to increase a little bit. But just in terms of acting and process, like, I definitely feel like, yeah, I know, you know, just as much or just as little as I did 10 years ago when I left drama school.
Well, it's a very healthy attitude, young man. Keep it up.
I hope so.
Well done, pal. Thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure.
Okay, Kingsley Benadire, One Night in Miami is brilliant. Amazon Prime Video next Friday. That's when it's released on the 15th of Jan.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
He's perfect as Prince Albert, and you'll soon be marvelling at his Christopher Marlowe. He joins the cast of A Discovery of Witches for Season 2, which starts tonight at 9 p.m. on Sky 1. So, ladies and gentlemen, we've got a witch, and he's here to scratch it. It's the dashing Tom Hughes.
Oh, that's very good. Morning, Tom.
Morning, Chris. How are you doing?
Very well. How are you?
Yeah, I'm well, man. Yeah, really good, thanks.
Good. Congratulations on this. How was it for you, A Discovery of Witches?
Yeah, it was great. It was wicked. I mean, I joined just for the second series, so obviously stepping into that, you're going to want to hit the ground running. But yeah, it's like a big family, the show, and they were incredibly welcoming, so it was wicked. I loved it.
And you haven't yet seen yourself in it, I'm hearing.
No, I haven't, no. I mean, I've done, you know, little bits in the kind of edit suite and things like that, but no, I haven't seen the finished article, shall we say.
Right, for people who don't know what it is, can you tell them?
Yeah, so, well, listen, they've still got 11 hours, so they can binge-watch season one if they want to, but in a nutshell, it kind of, you know, we're living a modern world in season one, and there's witches and demons and vampires that live in that world alongside humans, and we kind of chart the story of Diana Bishop, who is a witch, but kind of suppressing that instinct within her. And she summons this book at the start of season one that kind of has all the origins of the species in terms of witches, demons and vampires. And that alerts the whole supernatural world to her power and also the power of this book. And you go on this tumultuous kind of amazing story through that. And the main protagonist alongside her is this vampire played by Matthew Good. The character is also called Matthew in the show. And he becomes obsessed with her. And then there's this amazing kind of blossoming love story with a kind of Romeo and Juliet element of, you know, then not unrequited love, but kind of love against all odds, if you like.
Yeah.
And then at the end of that season, again, if people want to binge it, don't want to give it away, but they kind of flee to a different time and they land back at the start of season two in the 1590s. And Matthew's character, Matthew Beckett, has lived right through that period. And so as he lands, we meet myself playing Christopher Marlowe, who's a friend of Matthew's, but the Matthew he knows has gone to Scotland for 2 weeks, but has turned back up as a completely different version of himself, and that kind of sets the cat among the pigeons, shall we say.
Because I watched it last night. There's so much going on. It's brilliant. Now, Matthew's character, who is a vampire, or a werelock, he's called Matthew Good with an E, and Matthew in the show, the vampire. He also feeds on his wife, doesn't he? That's the thing. And they have to be careful that nobody twigs onto this.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, he's been a vampire, he's been alive for so long, you know, I think it's like 1,500 years.
Yeah.
He's kind of learned to control his urges. But obviously, you know, being a vampire, he has the thing called bloodlust and gets blood rage as well at times. And he needs to feed. And the more that he kind of, the more he falls passionately kind of attracted to Diana, the more that kind of bloodlust rises within him and the more he's kind of forced to try and control himself.
Right.
And so they're trying to find their way through that love between them while keeping each other safe and also, you know, being aware that could, like I said, set the cat amongst the pigeons, you know.
Well, and also 16th century London, you know, that's not difficult on the eye. What was it like being in it for a bit?
I'm unreal, man. I mean, we shot in Cardiff, and then there was a place in Plasmacken, which is like an old kind of, it's like a farm, and our production designer turned it into the 1590s. So you walk up this kind of muddy track, and you go through, you know, all the kind of the light rigs and all of that, and then you go through a double door, and there you are. You're completely transported back, and the magic of that for us was that you could move around. There was cobbled streets, there was houses, there were doors that opened into rooms, and Kit's dwellings were above a pub within it. So I kind of felt like, you know, when you stepped on set, you were transported already. You kind of made your job easier, you know.
So cool. And the costumes, I mean, Matthew Good, he scrubs up well, doesn't he?
Oh yeah, but you know, he always does, doesn't
he's
he?
Very
he always
handsome.
Does. I mean, like,
he seems to be getting younger. What if he's really a vampire? What if Matthew Good with an E is really actually a vampire?
I know he's not, but I've got to say, in scenes, like, it was quite, like, you know, all the kind of moments when Matthew, the character, goes through blood rage, you know, when I watched the first season before I was, you know, stepping into it, you kind of assume a lot of that is CGI, and of course there is certain amounts of CGI in the show, but when you're acting with Matthew, it's quite staggering, because when the character goes through those bits, you realise that 95-99% of it is him, and it's breathtaking what he can do. It's really, I've always been a fan of Matthew's, and I've been able to work with him a couple of times, which is great, and step back in and do that, and was wicked, man. He's a great guy.
Well, it takes one to know one. So you're saying that Matthew Good in real life isn't a vampire, because you were a vampire at school, weren't you? You were an actual vampire at school.
How do you know that? Yeah, well, I was. Yeah, that was my first ever job. Well, job, come on, I was 11 years old, what am I talking about? But I wasn't really a film fan growing up. It wasn't like a choice necessarily. I was just into kind of music and football. You know, I started playing the guitar when I was really young. And then when I got to high school, I kind of stopped playing for a bit because I started learning classical guitar. That's how I got into it. And then, I don't know, everyone was playing Oasis, and I kind of felt like Spanish Romance wasn't really cutting the mustard anymore. So I stopped playing. There was a teacher at school, he said, look, do you want to come and do this play? Because you've been on stage playing in bands and stuff. I think you'd be able to do it. And I was like, no, definitely not. And he went, you get 2 weeks off school. I was like, yeah, wicked, I'll
okay,
do it. And then I went and played Dracula. Yeah, in this play.
What
so I
laugh.
Guess my first role was a vampire.
Well,
yeah.
Good. Well, the first season, I'm sure you know this, but the first season of A Discovery of Witches is rated 94% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is just off the charts. And so you'll be watching season 2, starring your good self alongside your pals tonight. With who?
I'll be on my own, mate. I'll just be watching it at home, you know, as lockdown is here.
Is there a little furry friend in the background? Is that a car alarm?
Well, I thought I'd come in the garden just to kind of get a bit of a wake up with a cup of tea, and there's a dog going nuts. I think he's jealous.
Not your dog.
Not my dog. No, I don't have a dog. No.
Well, Tom,
so it'll just be me with a bottle of wine. Maybe that feels quite apt for the show.
All right, mate.
And enjoy it. Yeah.
Well done, Tom. It's lovely to talk to you again. Come and see us whenever you can, as soon as you can.
Nice one, bud. Take it easy. All the best.
All right, pal. Well done.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
She's learned lessons from her mental illness and packaged them up for the benefit of your mental wellness. Her new book, No Such Thing as Normal, is out now. And here with a wealth of mental health help is the coolest columnist around. It's the always brilliant Bryony Gordon.
Good morning, Bryony.
Good morning. Wow. Could you wake me up with that every morning?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll send Dave round. I'll have him washed and sent to you. No, not allowed, of course. No such thing as normal. What My Mental Illness Has Taught Me About Mental Wellness, Bryony Gordon, a brand new book, A Practical Guide to Mental Health. Now, Bryony, this interview and this show has interrupted the writing of your column for tomorrow's Telegraph. Now, that's a deadline, Bryony.
Yes, but it's fine. It's easy. I'd rather be talking to you, to be honest. I've got all day. I don't have to file it till midday.
Is that right?
It's easy. Yeah, it's easy.
Okay.
It's not. I'm just going to write about the book, actually.
Good.
I'm going to use it to plug the book.
Well done. Congratulations. Before we go any further, do you really go to bed on a bed of nails?
Sometimes I have this thing called like an acupuncture mat.
Right.
And it's really, I know it doesn't sound relaxing, but it's one of the best things I do for my well-being. You can order them off Amazon for like 20 quid.
Right.
And they are, if I can say the word, almost orgasmic. Fantastic.
Okay, because you mentioned page 36. You haven't come here to read and rant about meditation, nor do I want to write a rant about meditation. The practice of mindfulness and meditation are tremendous, and I will never ever go to do down anything that makes people happy, especially not when I lie down on a bed of nails several times a week. I'm like, what is that about? Now I know.
They're fantastic. They really are. They sound a bit kind of like hippie-ish, but they're really good.
I've
discovered it during the first lockdown.
Now, this is, again, a very useful book. It's like a sort of snack box of things that you've sort of come across and that you've used, you've employed, you've tested out for us so we don't have to. But you also talk about making room for our emotions. And you talk about the fact that people with mental health challenges seem to have fared pretty well, you know, considering everything, during the COVID pandemic, because they're sort of used to turbulence.
Yeah, so that was what I got the idea from the book, because in the run-up to the first lockdown, I found it was not easy, but I took it in my stride, whereas the people that had previously taken life in their stride and not had any kind of mental health crisis really struggled. And I realized then that a lot of the things I had thought were kind of flaws and failures in my life, like the OCD, depression, alcoholism, were actually more like superpowers. Like, I had learned so much. And I don't know about you, but I can't speak for you, obviously, but anyone listening, like, I don't know, as someone who's experienced mental illness, I have been preparing for the end of the world since I was like 9.
Yep.
And so when the end of the world as we knew it happened, I was like, actually, this is okay. And it was like, I'm going through this with everyone. You know, compared to a lockdown in your own head, which is, you know, what depression is like, it was okay. But so it gave me the idea that I wanted to, like, get all of the, you know, we should actually be looking to people that have experienced mental illness for advice, which was what happening to me. It was like this curious inversion of norms where people were asking me for advice. I was like, what? And I was like, actually, I have learned a lot through this illness. I have learned a lot about wellness. And so I wanted to kind of put it all in a book. What are the kind of things? Because you get, there's a lot of mental health advice out there that's kind of quite vague and woolly, isn't there? That isn't actually, you know, it's sort of meditate or, you know, do mindfulness. But trying to do that when you're in crisis is like asking someone in a lead suit to go for a swim. You know, it's really hard. So I was like, what are the basic things that would have helped me the first time I had OCD when I was 11 and I couldn't leave the house for 3 months? Do you know what I mean? And so I wanted to get those basic things in, but also I work with a lot of mental health professionals to create a kind of central chapter, which is all about how to ask for help, because we hear so much about how poor mental health provision is in this country, which in itself isn't actually that helpful if you're in crisis. So I wanted to, like, because there is help there. So I spoke to lots of GPs and doctors and counsellors about how best to access the system and what there is available to you and what the kind of waiting time should be. So there's that kind of practical element to it too.
Yeah, it's very important. And the way you describe it there, it sounds heavy, but that's because, as always, Bryony's done the heavy lifting for us. And from all that hard homework that you've just been hearing about there, she's distilled it all down. And it's, once again, it's gorgeous, full of expletives, full of Trump-esque style uppercase. Can't get enough of that, Bryony. Keep that coming. That's perfect. You know, and you talk about breathing in there. You talk about the sleeping in there. I love the chapter on getting out of your own way.
Yes. Well, because I talk about how I've realized that all of my mental health issues, I describe them as like little goblins in my head, right?
Yeah.
And the voice of the goblin is, the voice of your mental illness is incredibly similar to your own. So you may feel that you don't want to get out of bed. You don't want to get up. You've got to basically do the opposite of what you want to do when you're in mental health crisis and get out of your own way. And it's starting in those simple things. Like, even if it's just right now, if someone's listening and they don't want to get out of bed, it's like, get out of bed and go get yourself a glass of water. That's all you have to do. Do you know what I mean? It's those tiny little steps of getting out of your own way, but it's really getting out of the way of the goblin in your head, so to speak.
Right, get back to your day job, off you go. Thank you, Bryony.
Thank you for having me.
Well done. You're always welcome. No Such Thing as Normal, Bryony Gordon. It's out now and it is fabulous. Seriously fabulous.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
He's the culinary king determined to kickstart your New Year diet in style. His new book, Eat Better Forever, is out now. And here to give us a delightful bellyful in the most mindful of ways is the ravishing rascal of River Cottage himself. It's Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall.
Good morning, Hugh.
Morning.
Good morning. How are you today? You all right?
Yeah, I'm very well.
Often these books here are all about the title, Eat Better Forever. That is a grand claim. I love it. It's so sort of confident. And as you begin to read the book, I sort of agree with you. Eat Better Forever. Let's do it. Your 7 ways to transform your diet. Give us the headlines.
Well, the headlines is that this is not a single fixed diet. Publishers love to come up with one concept. You put all your eggs in one healthy eating or weight loss basket. For me, that makes the idea of success or failure very binary, and it can be quite stressful. And actually, healthy eating isn't a binary or one big idea thing. We know quite a lot about what's healthy now. So I wanted to lay out seven strategies that all support each other. Even one or two of them will be really helpful. But if you do, it's like making seven little New Year's resolutions instead of one big one. And, you know, you concentrate on two or three of them at a time. And over time, they look after you really well. So it's just a much more sustainable approach.
Well, it's much more achievable and sustainable, isn't it? That's the thing.
Absolutely. That's exactly the idea.
All right. So retrain your sweet tooth is here, page 104. Now, Vassos, he seems to be unfolding as the main subject of this interview. He gave up sugar 4 days ago. That's a whole different story, but he could really do with this. So give us the basics on retraining your sweet tooth.
That's really interesting that Vassos has given up sugar, and I hope he gets on really well with that. My approach would probably be to dial down the sugar a little bit, to do it gradually rather than go completely cold turkey on it. And I mean, I have a super sweet tooth. I used to be the pudding chef at the River Cafe many years ago, making tarts and cakes and ice creams. And I still love to do home baking, and all my family loves a treat. But recently, one thing I've discovered is you can take pretty much 20% of the sugar out of any traditional cake or biscuit recipe. And you know what? Nobody even notices. You can start swapping in that light wholemeal flour instead of white flour. Again, people love it. So there's lots you can do to kind of hole up your treaty baking. In fact, the last chapter of the recipe chapter of the book is all about delicious treats that are not laden with sugar. They're not sugar-free, but they've got much more whole ingredients, nuts and seeds, but there's some chocolatey treats there. There's a lovely seedy cake that's got all kinds of good things in it, ground almonds, wholemeal flour. But this is not kind of old-school 70s, you know, brown rice and lentil stuff. It's delicious home baking, but just made a bit holer.
No, I agree. I concur. Mindful drinking and mindful eating. Which would you like to take on those first?
Well, of course, they're really connected. Mindfulness is the seventh of my seven ways. And you said, you know, you used the phrase woo-woo. You know, these things can be interpreted as being a little bit hippy-dippy. But all mindfulness means in the context of food and drink is that while you're eating, or even while you're cooking and preparing food, you're thinking about the food. You know, you are with the food. You're with your eating. You're not. So because we do an awful lot of mindless eating, we eating and snacking and grazing while thinking about or doing something completely different. But if we take a little bit of time out when we eat to be with the food, we can relish it a little bit more. A little bit less of it goes a little bit further. And this is the wrapping, if you like, for the rest of my six strategies. The mindfulness is really, really important.
And it is. It's so important. And once you get into it, you can't get out of it. It's one of those traps that you get into that does you a favor. And you think, no, this is a jail cell that I don't mind, you know, a life sentence in. Because I used to love a wine gum right here. I used to love a wine gum. And I'd get a wine gum. You know, I'd get five wine gums on the side. And I'd be reading a book. And since I've become more mindful, I can't do that anymore. Because I'm not enjoying the wine gum and I'm not enjoying the book. So I can't do the two things at once because we can't multitask. That's a myth, isn't it? There is no such thing as multitasking. You get task switching. And that because we can only do one thing at a time as a human being. From a binary point of view, as far as our brains is concerned, we are unable. We can trick ourselves into thinking we're multitasking, but we're not. We're just micro task switching. And therefore, if I'm chewing a wine gum and I'm reading a book, I can't do the two at the same time. That is impossible. So sometime during the whole process, I'm missing out on one because of the other.
Yeah, I think that's entirely right. And, you know, I think you're better off taking time out to just maybe have one wine gum and to relish every single chew and suck of that delicious item, you know, second by second.
Yes.
And then you'll find that one of them has probably done the job that five or six of them used to do.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And the whole, you know, have I got time for the wine gum? The contemplation, is it the right day for a wine gum? You know, that kind of thing. And then the investment is massive. And even if it's a no at the end of it, it's a good no. It's a big, fat, solid no, you know, or a big, fat, solid yes. And either will do.
Absolutely. Decisiveness and being with the food is key.
With the food.
The other thing that's really interesting about the mindfulness is being mindful about when you're not eating. And Chris, I know you've dabbled with intermittent fasting, haven't you? And
yeah.
you've versions of that where you where you do all your, you know, you, we call it the 16-8, where you do your eight, you do your eating between maybe 12 noon and 8 in the evening. Mm-hmm. And I do that sometimes. I put in, for me, fasting, again, it's not a be-all and end-all part of healthy eating. It's not like the single fix, but it is a very useful tool, and it can be a turbo boost for some of the other strategies in the book. So for me, mindfulness is, fasting is part of mindfulness, and being with your hunger and acknowledging that right now you're hungry, but actually you can be hungry for another hour or two before you have to go and find some food. It's a little bit of mindfulness and tuning in on that feeling that will help you get past and let you feel you don't need to reach for a snack at that moment.
Yeah, it's all good. It's all very good. Right, Hugh, great book. Well done, pal. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year, guys.
Okay, Eat Better Forever. What a title and what a book by Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
They're identical twins, former male models and a current business phenomenon. Their latest cookbook, The Happy Health Plan, is out now, and they're here with oodles of plant-based perfection. Get ready for some Tuck of the Irish. It's the wonderfully happy pair, Stephen and David Flynn.
Good morning, boys.
What a wonderful intro. What an honour, Chris.
Well, it's great to talk to you both. I've heard you both before lots of times on various podcasts with Rich and those kind of guys. How are you doing? How's your Christmas been? What's the story so far for you guys in 2021?
Gosh, so far, 4 days into it, we're making the most of it. You know, we did our training this morning, we had a swim in the sea, and we're delighted to be here.
Right, for people who don't know, and there'll be loads of them, so let's educate them. How did you two become the happy pair? Did it begin with the open water swimming and this sort of casual, unofficial swimming club that seemed to garnered momentum? You were both male models, of course. What is your history in catering? Give us a sort of cheat sheet, a 60-second cheat sheet on who you guys are.
Okay, 60 seconds. Here we go. We're going to spit it up. So we grew up in a small town in Greystones, all boys family, all boys schools, very masculine upbringing. And we ended up, by the time of studying business, like being identical twins, we used to eat a meat and two veg diet. We went on a journey of self-discovery. And through that journey, we realized we were really into health, happiness, and community. So we started our business, which we call The Happy Pair, with this Walt Disney dream of creating a happier, healthier world and building community. And this was back in 2004. We left as two meathead jocks and then came back 2 years later as two idealists that wanted to start a vegetable shop.
The transformation, was there a moment of epiphany, a realization?
Yeah, I think it was more as soon as we left Greystones and our own social conditioning, we kind of realized that, you know, we wanted to explore and see what else gave us meaning in life. And we found health was hugely important. And we changed to a plant-based diet. This is back 20 years ago. And that's been the hallmark. That changed so much within our own life. And it kind of forced us, it kind of was the formative thing for us to create The Happy Pair, which was a vegetable shop. And it's grown into also, it's grown arms and legs now. And kind of
and festivals and retreats and shows as well.
Yeah, kind of. It started out with a little vegetable shop. We've three cafes. We have about 50 products and about 1,000 stores. We've written 5 best-selling cookbooks, and it's all about the same thing as trying to get people to eat more fruit and veg. You know, so it's really, you know, that's the whole emphasis behind everything, is trying to inspire people to eat more fruit and veg and live a happier, healthier life.
Really. All right. Lovely stuff in this one. Straight away, I'm drawn to page 158, Easy Miso Soup, 3 Ways. I love miso soup. Why is it so good for us?
It's wonderful. It's full of, like, it's very cleansing for toxins. My kids love it as well, which is surprising. So for any parents, it's a great one for kids. It takes 5 to 10 minutes to make. And it's full of flavor and you can get lots of veg in it. So,
and miso is something that traditionally over here we're not used to eating. And it's something that's often the fermented food group is labeled the forgotten food group. But I guess during this pandemic, we're all becoming more aware of the importance of having a strong immune system. And fermented foods and eating fiber-rich foods are so important because 70% of our immune system lives in our gut or our microbiome. Yeah. And 9 out of 10 people in the UK don't eat enough fibre, and you only get fibre from fruit, veg, beans, legumes and whole grains.
Yeah, so, and there's different kinds of fibre, aren't there?
Yeah, yeah, there's soluble and unsoluble. But I think the main thing is, like for anyone listening, I think the main thing is just to try to eat more fruit and veg. Like, it's very straightforward, and I think it's applicable to everyone listening. It doesn't have to be, I'm eating a vegan diet. It's literally
just try to eat more fruit and veg because the benefits are so plentiful. I guess we've had about 50,000 people from all over the world through our online health plans. And we've seen the benefit so many times just simply eating more fruit and veg.
Even there on Christmas Eve, I was outside our shop and a guy came up to me and he was probably 65 years old. His name was John. And he said to me, listen, I just did one of your plans and it's changed my life. Myself, my wife, my health improved dramatically. I can now eat loads of food. So it's a wonderful thing. Just eating more fruit and veg, that's the name of the game.
Yeah, absolutely. We did, for the first time ever, we got a stalk of Brussels sprouts that looked like jingle bells, literally. And I didn't know, but you can just throw them in the oven like that as a roast on the stalk.
And they look beautiful,
oh,
don't they?
Oh, they do. They look amazing.
Like, they're wood, like they really are like a big stack of bells. And I think it just helps preserve them a lot more, which is brilliant and a nice thing, you know. And for many people listening, they might kind of go, oh, the lads, that you're just chefs. Like, what are you talking about? We kind of partnered with a lot of doctors and dietitians. And so it's kind of rooted in science, the sense of eating more fruit and veg.
And even back last year, we ended up back pre-corona, we ended up forming this thing called the Southwest Plant-Based Challenge, which was done in Devon. It was 79 doctors, which a friend, he wanted to approve the benefit of plant-based diet. So we put 79 doctors on a plant-based diet for 4 weeks. And we went over there and launched the program, one of our plans. And at the end of it, there was a 27% drop in LDL cholesterol, an average drop of 5 kg in weight. And three quarters of the doctors said that they were going to continue on with a plant-based diet. And 98% said they'd recommend it to their patients. So it's it works.
Yeah,
and we're not saying that anyone needs to be a vegan or a vegetarian in anything. It's really all of us want to wake up and have more energy.
Yeah, yeah.
Feel better. And it's hard now in lockdown, like it really is, but it's about like we all want to have better immunities and better mental health, and food has such a massive importance to it, and we kind of forget this. It's easy to kind of get caught in a rut of eating, you know, processed foods and junk foods, and it's just such an important thing.
Okay, boys, well done, thank you so much. How was the swim this morning?
Cold.
It's about 6 degrees, fresh, but so invigorating.
Well,
really
hang on a minute. You've been open water swimming for ages. If you think it's cold, God help the rest of us. Vassos has started open water swimming and he gets trouble with his hands and his feet being cold. Can you get over that without having to wear things?
Well, we just had a foot bath there after it, so that definitely
glorious.
Helps.
But this, for anyone listening, it's something so like glorious about facing that discomfort. Like, I always quite like that stoic ideology that like, when you face a bit of discomfort, you can appreciate comfort a lot more. And through a cold shower, getting in the cold sea, suddenly like putting a blanket around me, I feel like I deserve this. I've earned this.
I deserve my cup of coffee. I deserve my whatever.
So right.
And the sea might be unrelatable to most people, but it could be a run. It could be a yoga class. It could be anything that you can do to make you feel good that forces you out of your comfort zone.
Right. Well, guys, you're awesome. And if you want fuel for any of those pastimes or others that are good for you, the Happy Healthy Plan is out now. And that's the boys live from Ireland, David and Stephen Flynn.
The best of the Chris Evans Breakfast Show with Sky on Virgin Radio.
Thank you so much for listening to this, the podcast of the Virgin Radio Breakfast Show. Don't forget, you can subscribe and get it every week from wherever you get your podcast, and you will never miss the weekly roundup of all the best bits from our Virgin Radio Breakfast Show with Sky.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.